JFK was killed in Dallas, Texas. I never enjoyed Dallas. Too high.
From the Book Suppository Building, apparently.
Governor Connolly, they call it the magic bullet. I bet Governor Connolly doesn't call it that at all. He probably calls it the unlucky bullet. Hit him three times.
The motorcade taking a timeout as the governor picks up his hat.
Oh. 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Injection, fellas. Suicide is a suicide. Suicide is a
suicide. Suicide is a suicide. This is the conspiratorial view of history, as opposed to the accidental view. And it is the conspiratorial view that we shall present in this program.
The world is engaged in the most difficult and trying struggle in its long history. All of the great epics which have torn the world for the last 2,000 years pale in comparison to the great ideological gulf which separates us from those who oppose us. It is our responsibility not merely to denounce our enemies and those who make themselves our enemies, but to make this system work, to demonstrate what freedom can do, what those who are committed to freedom and the future can do. So I realize that this meeting is not only a meeting of the youth today, but those of whom we expect so much in the future. Winston Churchill once said that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the other systems that have been tried.
You can be right or you can be popular, and we live in a democracy.
Jefferson said, if you expect a country to be ignorant and free, you expect what never was and never will be.
Enough of them as we mentioned whenever I rap on the microphone, cause I know how to write the rhythm, know how to roll like a pro. Some call me JFK and some of them call me Metro. I got the sound that'll move your body, sound that'll make your body go. Sound that'll make you move, I said now, sound that'll make you sweat. Sound of the Metro beat now coming in live and direct. Conspirator are massive, said you'll never forget. We got the heavyweight sound and that is no argument.
When we play for the girls and the boys, at the end of the time I make a whole heap of noise. When I got the mic and I shut up with my voice, everybody knew me at the people's choice. Man, I'm dance hollers in the dark party. Listen, I'm seeing the young at the top celebrity.
Down that iPhone or BlackBerry, look up from your computer screen or video game, stop texting, emailing, chatting online. It turns out that the internet could be driving us crazy.
Kind of stuff in the second hour, especially what we were thinking about doing is because we come up to that very ominous day, November 22nd, when John F. Kennedy was assassinated, and people consternate about not getting down to the bottom of 9/11. Well, if you take a look at it, I mean, we're still spinning somewhere in space about the assassination. At least most of America still is. So. What I wanted to do is, Jacob, you know, you said you had an interesting take on this, and we kind of talked a little bit about it off mic, and yeah, it is interesting, and I think it really is at the base of what we should really be thinking about, so I'm going to throw it over to you. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, with the current passage of the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, you make fascinating and very salient points on your show about the absolute particulars may never be found out. The fact that it wasn't Osama and 19 flying circus hijackers with box cutters, that didn't happen. That's the most important part we're being lied to, is the evident part. The rest may not be able to be figured out. You know, with the planes, the no planes, the, you know, thermite, bombs, directed energies, mini nukes, you know, there's just so much information, disinformation, and everything in between that it's really difficult. And like you mentioned, you could get lost in that, arguing those points forever. I don't think that they are insignificant, and if people, you know, are on their own journey or, you know, wish to study all of them, you know, I find no qualm with that. But then when we turn against ourselves, those, you know, who claim to be awake, and being on the same team, i.e., you know, they're lying to us, and then start fighting with each other over how exactly it happened, whether it was holograms or drones or real planes, you know, we get lost in trying to be right. And like you point out, that isn't fruitful. It doesn't progress us forward, and in fact, I see that as part of the plan. You know, with all of my 9/11 studies and work in radio and the internet, you know, there's evidence for explosives, there's evidence for thermite, there's evidence for directed energy, there's evidence that gasoline got some steel hot. So all of the, and the more I study this, the more I come to the conclusion, and this is through the help of Sir Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. I had took it upon myself to read all 1,022 pages of the complete works of Mr. Doyle, Sir Doyle, his quasi-holiness, in the Sherlock Holmes writings. And a point that's made constantly when investigating bizarre, sometimes they're crimes, sometimes they're just situations, that he constantly makes the point that all of the evidence has to be included, no matter what, how improbable, you know, the conclusion leads to. And what I've noticed with the event of 9/11 is that all of these things are there. I've seen fake video, I've seen real video, I've seen things explode, I think seen concrete turn to concrete steam. You know, there's the thermite reaction pouring out of one of the corners of the building. So everybody, instead of trying to pick which one they like and fight over that and discluding all the rest, through my new perspective after reading the Bible of Sherlock Holmes, is that maybe we have to include all of these. And then what does that lead us to? It leads us to the next layer of this operation, which is no matter what camp you fall in, you know, we turn on each other. And that seems to be part of the operation, just like the hijackings, just like the impacts, just like the demolitions, just like the Pentagon, are all parts of the operation. So are the multiple trails built into them. So as kind of like part of the escape plan, let's say, they've built these separate verifiable and non-verifiable scenarios into the equation, so the people that are onto the lie then turn against each other, trying to decipher which one of those it is. And in fact, I've switched my perspective to including all of them, because I think they're all relevant and all pertinent, and I don't think it's just one. I think it's multiple, with the intent of, you know, distracting the rest of us who are onto the trail. And so I think our last show, we kind of touched on that, and you've definitely hit that with broadcast sense. And I firmly agree, nobody's ever going to be found right. All of these camps are just that, camps. And the big tent approach kind of seems to be where we need to go. And so with the anniversary, I've combed over the terabytes of information I've downloaded and collected over the years to the JFK assassination, and I see a huge similarity, whether people take the Lee Harvey Oswald theory or the other shooter from the school book depository with the photographic evidence of other windows open. There's the storm drain theory, the grassy knoll theory, the limo driver theory, the Jacqueline Kennedy in the Derringer theory, and when you examine each one of these, it appears, and what I noticed is that they're all kind of equally inconclusive.
Did you ever work for the CIA?
You make it sound like some remote experience in ancient history. Man, you don't leave the agency. Once you're in, they got you for life.
Shaw?
Shaw? Shaw's an untouchable, highest clearance. Shaw, Oswald, the Cubans, all agency.
What about Ruby?
Jack was a pimp. He was a bagman for the Dallas mob. He used to run guns to Castro when he was still on our side. We almost had Castro with us, then we tried to whack him. Everybody's flipping sides all the time. It's funny games, man, funny games.
What about the mob, Dave? How are they figuring this?
The agency too, man. CIA and the mafia working together, trying to whack out the beard, mutual interest. They've been doing it for years. There's more of this than you could dream. Well, check out something called Mongoose, Operation Mongoose.
Mongoose?
Government, Pentagon stuff. They're in charge. But who the fuck pulls whose chain? Who the fuck knows? Oh, what a deadly web we weave when we practice to deceive.
And who killed the president?
Oh, man, why don't you stop it? This is too big for you. You know that? This is... Who did the president? Who killed Ken? Man, it's a mystery. It's a mystery wrapped in a riddle inside an enigma. The shooters don't even know. Don't you get it?
You know, the thing we forget, though, and because most of us are taught that some of the demises of presidents have been lone gunmen or... a cult 30 days into one's presidency. But you take a look at, even if you're going to give me the benefit of the doubt, you can go back to William Henry Harrison, and for certain things that he had said about not recognizing
cult,
the divine right of monarchs to rule, wound up dead 30 days afterwards. And then you take a look at Zachary Taylor. Oh, well, there's an excuse for that. That's the way I look at it. But, I mean, then later on, you've got Buchanan, whose inaugural party was assassinated in toto. He didn't die, but I don't know. I think a dozen or more did. And then you got Lincoln, and then you got Garfield, and you got McKinley, and you got a wonder about Harding. and you got an attempt at miss on FDR, supposedly. I mean, and then it goes on and on. I mean, and then later after JFK, you've got the attempt on Reagan. You know, for a country that's supposedly civilized, man, we got a lot of assassinations, and all supposedly that weren't organic, so, you know, like the Harrison's Cold, by lone gunmen. That is an incredible record of success for lone nut gunmen. I mean, they get it pretty much every single time.
That's how conspiracy works. Them boys on the grassy knoll, they were dead within 3 hours. Buried in the damn desert, unmarked graves out past Terralingua.
You know this for a fact?
Still got the shovel.
You know, that brings in a whole new set of issues, ramifications, and the whole bit. But, yeah, you're exactly right. How are they all gotten to so easily? You know, and like you said, the lone nutter working every time, you know, is ridiculous, and it should make, you know, the whole thing seem obvious. Just like when I argue 9/11 with people that, you know, aren't even up to speed on any of it, I ask them how anything hit the Pentagon. Anything. I don't care if it was a missile, an airplane, a kite, one of these remote control C4 drones that these FBI informants want to build. How did anything? Isn't that a no-fly zone? Isn't that a fortress of some kind? There's no surface-to-air missiles. You know, the fact that anything hit it should be proof positive. One, they knew and or did it, or two, they should all be hung the next day, if not, you know, fired and you know, drawn and quartered. I mean, it's just outrageous once you take a step back and look, like you're saying, at the entirety of assassinations. You know, JFK gets a lot of the headlines, but, you know, this has been going on the entire time.
All right. Now, having said that, do you want to tread upon thin ice and start to give us perhaps what you think happened, or if that's important? But I mean, by all means, you know, let's hear it. I mean, I have a pretty entrenched feeling and understanding about what happened that day. I think I'm right. I don't know, but I'm going to throw it to you, because I mean, I don't know where you want to go with this, although that will open up, without a doubt, you know, a whole bunch of avenues, or some people would say cans of worms.
Oh yeah, I've got worm juice all over my shoes already. And you know, I'm not married. Okay, you're pretty familiar with Robert Anton Wilson, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And his idea of maybe philosophy, that so many people are married to their ideas, and he talks about, instead of using is, you know, if we just use maybe in our philosophical ponderings, you know, how much we could change the energy and atmosphere of certain discussions. Because, you know, none of us were there. None of us know absolutely for sure. We're all doing our best with educated guesses, and some are more educated than others. But, you know, it's difficult because no one really knows. And so this is a maybe pontification I've had, because I've, like I said, went through all of this video footage again. And there were several pieces that kind of dangle around that don't fit very well into a lot of this stuff. You know, get ready for the phone to blow up and the emails. And like I said, this is just a maybe. I'm not married to it. I wasn't there. I was born in 77, so this was, you know, two octaves before I was even...
No excuses.
Before I was born. But there's certain evidence that makes me wonder. And I'll make the statement first, and then we can kind of go over what pieces I've seen that make me think that. I wonder if maybe JFK was one of the conspirators.
Y'all got to start thinking on a different level, like the CIA does. Now, we're through the looking glass here, people. White is black, and black is white.
The first piece of evidence is really a bunch of pieces. He, you know, he pissed off the Russians. He pissed off the Cubans. He pissed off the bankers, allegedly, and we'll get into that in just a second. He snubbed one of the Dulles brothers in a handshake live on TV. He makes a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy speech. He's an adulterer. I think it's pretty proven that the voting didn't necessarily turn out in his favor before the wee hours of the morning.
No, it's before the dead people got it voted.
Right. The Kennedy family themselves, are you familiar with Operation Aphrodite and the older Kennedy, where go ahead.
No, I'm just going to say, I mean, Joe was a son of a bitch.
Right. Operation Aphrodite was an Army Air Corps, I don't think they were Air Force at that time, program to devise a way to use airplanes as missiles. They had a couple approaches. They would do just a full-on remote control, tailing the bombing plane, the plane loaded with explosives. They would tail it with a cargo ship and remote control the airplane into targets, chock full of explosives. They also had another way where the pilot and co-pilot, took off normally with the plane full of explosives, and then they would, set the cruise control, bail out, parachute to safety, and watch the plane blow up into its target. And if you fast forward just briefly into, airplanes used as missiles, there's, another connection with 9/11. But the larger context of the Kennedys not being necessarily nice people. I'm not a prohibitionist, but I'm also not for organized crime. So whether or not alcohol was illegal or not, these people still made a massive fortune through gangsterism, through black operations that eventually led in one fashion to 9/11. The election was stolen. There was, like I said, lots of philandering. And then magically, he seems to irritate, annoy, or peeve every power block on the planet, which, like I said, is possible, but maybe that's part of the design. And another thing I've noticed when researching operations like these, a lot of these operations are put into play way before they're pulled off. The Bush administration isn't the alpha and omega of that thing. This has been in the works for quite a while. And I think the same thing is similar with JFK. Even if you want to take a bare bones Lee Harvey Oswald approach, this man was sent to Russia, and the whole bit to tie him into communism, whether that's completely erroneous or not. But that was definitely, set into play for the fact that he was going to be a patsy and the communist angle could be exploited later on. So if these things are set into motion that far ahead, it's hard to think that, the speech, the snubbing of the Dulles brothers. And here's another one. There's, for example, Obama campaigned on, I'm going to close Gitmo. And then I'm going to close Gitmo, and then I'm going to close Gitmo. Then he gets in there, and he doesn't close Gitmo. And we hear a lot of times in Patriot lore that JFK was going to, do things that made the Vietnam War, unattainable for the Hunt oil conglomerations and the Bell helicopter crowd and all these other people that profit off of war. And so, the point I was trying to tie together there, though I've heard the rhetoric he was not for the Vietnam War, I've never seen any conclusive evidence that he did anything to stop it because we had the Vietnam War.
Oh. think of my dying bed. Mimi, Jesus, Mimi, meet me in the middle of the air. If these are wings should fail me, Lord, won't you bring me another pair? So well, 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 so I can die easier. Well, well, well. Well, 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 so I can die easier. Jesus gonna make my dying bed.
When I
as I put these pieces together, I'm putting them in a gray bucket and using maybe all the way across. I got to the Presidential Directive 11101, or I may have the amount of ones and zeros incorrect, but the deal about silver certificates, and everybody says, oh, well, he took a stab at the Federal Reserve, and he was going to start issuing, you know, paper.
No, it was going to be silver certificates to replace the Federal Reserve notes.
Right.
Is that right? Okay.
And so I actually went and read Presidential Directive 11101, and it refers to an earlier presidential directive, which gives the power that the president used to have, that the previous presidential directive gave the president the ability to issue silver certificates. 11101 referred back to that and reinstituted that power to the Secretary of the Treasury, who was at that time a Federal Reserve banker and I think has been ever since. So they did issue silver certificates in the amount of a few billion and were quickly recalled, but that's not proof he was taking a jab at the bankers, because if you look and actually read the presidential directives, he gave them more power, and he gave away the presidential authority to issue silver certificates right into the hands of a Federal Reserve chairman.
All right, now let me just hold you there, because I have to agree with you. As much as it seems on face, at least superficially, that he was kicking the can of the Federal Reserve, I kind of don't think he did. And where you're coming from is I agree with, because I just don't think that was the case. And also, what's so strange, too, is, and remember, when you think about the Federal Reserve and the fact that it was created by Wilson Watt in 1913, and then the income tax came in after, well, the income tax came in and around it. I don't know how it just went, which was first, but you needed something to feed the beast, and, of course, the income tax was the thing to do. But you know what's overlooked time and time again, and that is, look at that. Congress took a power that was given to them, and they went ahead and farmed it out to a private bank, and nobody, I mean, that was never brought up in court. I mean, that never made its way through anything.
Right.
If there was anything that was ever unconstitutional, it was the Congress giving what was their responsibility to the Fed. Incredible. So at any rate, I mean, that Kennedy didn't try to poke a stick in the eye of the Fed does not really surprise me. Because really, I mean, who's going to listen? It's not going to happen. Even when you see it today, Jacob, I mean, the president gets up there and says, look, we want to help out people who are underwater in their mortgages. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. And the banks are sitting there going like, is that right? Is that right? So, I mean, so Obama looks good to the people, and the bankers just say, kiss my ass. And here we go, on and on again. So, I mean, I'm sorry to go through that little circuitous side street there, but I just wanted to throw that out, and I happen to agree with you, for whatever it means, that I don't think JFK going after the Fed was the big deal.
No, and here's another little piece of that puzzle that I'm intimately familiar with, having lived in Kansas City for 12 years and currently in the Kansas side of Kansas City tonight. The Hunt family is a big player in the shadow elite. H.L. Hunt, Lamar's father. Okay, let me start this way. The Kansas City Chiefs here locally are owned by Lamar Hunt.
Days of the Dallas Texans, yep.
Yeah, well, and funny enough, they moved the Dallas Texans to Kansas City in 1963, maybe to diversify in case things went down.
Okay.
And the Dallas part isn't coincidental. And Lamar is a Silver Spoon guy. His dad was the billionaire. So this, technically, you know, Lamar was given the Texans to take to Kansas City. But that wasn't, you know, his team or his money. That was daddy's money.
All right, who was the one that cornered silver?
There. Here's where we're coming.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's Lamar Hunt's dad, H.L. Hunt, he owned Hunt Oil, which was like the Halliburton of the Vietnam era. they've got all the contracts for the military fuel and refuel and, you know, lots of other things. Daddy Hunt was a polygamist. He had two wives and a live-in girlfriend with which they had 14 children altogether, Lamar being one of those. Now, if you put all of those brothers and sisters together, I forget the name of the one that is the silver magnate, but yes, the Hunt family was intimately involved in cornering the silver market, i.e. Presidential Directive 111101, giving the authority of these. If you think like an accountant and a scumbag, that was a payoff in some way or another to the people who corner the silver markets, which are the Hunts, which also, and I think I mentioned to you this in an email once, in the, you know, how these organized crime groups work, you know, if the Hunt family is an established, you know, multi-generational billionaire family in Dallas, the president isn't getting shot in his backyard without his prior knowledge, let's say. And then you can look at all the no-bid contracts through Hunt Oil on down to the silver market. And this family is fascinating because they also do a lot of underground construction. They dig tunnels for the super colliders. They have underground warehouses here. And in this process, so they get a contract to dig these giant caves for whatever reason. And in doing so, they come across things like silver and other precious metals, you know, the land above these things. And so it's kind of like the railroad tycoons weren't made filthy rich by the railroads. They were made filthy rich by the five-mile window on either side of the tracks they got for all the hotels, restaurants, and whorehouses.
Interesting. Also, that goes back to the Sherman brothers. One was John, who supposedly created the Sherman Antitrust Act that supposedly busted the trust, but all it did was close the door behind Rockefeller and the other ones who had already made it. And, of course, his brother, who was rather renowned for killing Confederates and Indians.
Absolutely. Sherman's March to the Sea. So, and that's a perfect analogy to this Hunt family, that they're working both ends of this thing. You know, there's a movie called, I want to say it's The International, but that might not be right. And in this, the Clive Lewis or the Clive guy, anyway, he works for Interpol, and he's trying to work out this, he's on the case of some international arms deal. And in the investigation of this international arms deal, there's a scene in the movie where, you know, he's questioning this arms dealer about why, you know, why do you guys care about missiles and, you know, is there that much money to be made? And it's kind of like a Howard Beale, Ned Beatty moment.
Whoa, it's us! We're in a lot of trouble!
And he tells this Interpol detective quite plainly.
Mr. Calvini, we'd like to know why the IBBC, a bank, would be purchasing hundreds of millions of dollars worth of missile guidance and control systems from your company.
The IBBC has purchased billions of dollars worth of Silkworm missiles from the People's Republic of China, which they have pre-sold to clients in the Middle East, contingent upon the missiles being equipped with Vulcan guidance systems. My company is one of only two in the world which produce the Vulcan.
Who's the other?
Sunay. Ahmed Sunay.
Of Turkish Aerotech.
But why is the bank committing so much of its capital and resources to the sale of these missiles?
It's a test. Small arms are the only weapons used in 99% of the world's conflicts. And no one has the capacity to manufacture them faster and cheaper than China. What Skarsen is attempting to do is to make the IBBC the exclusive broker of Chinese small arms to the Third World. And the missile deal is the gateway transaction.
Yeah, but billions of dollars invested simply to be a broker. There can't be that much profit for them.
No, this is not about making profit from weapon sales. It's about control.
Control the flow of weapons, control the conflict.
No. No, no. The IBBC is a bank. Their objective isn't to control the conflict. It's to control the debt that the conflict produces. You see, the real value of a conflict, the true value, is in the debt that it creates. You control the debt, you control everything. You find this upsetting, yes? But this is the very essence of the banking industry. To make us all, whether we be nations or individuals, slaves to debt.
Just like Sherman and his brother, you go tear up the South, burn it all down, put the kibosh on any monopolies passed here, and they just, reduce to the number of one who the South could go for to rebuild.
Also, Sherman was whacking the native people because the railroad was going through, and he was the one who knew it and bought land, as you just said, along the easements where the good stuff would go up when the train, when the railroad finally got put through.
Absolutely, and not to get my tinfoil hat too shiny, but Sherman lit his first fire on a Tuesday, September 11th, 1865 or 6, I forget which.
Just can't make this stuff up.
I don't think Kennedy did anything to the Federal Reserve. I don't think Kennedy did anything to the Dulles brothers. I don't think Kennedy did anything to, and the Bay of Pigs, I don't even have a maybe guess on what happened there. So, however they did or didn't piss off the Cubans, I like your take the best about maybe that whole conflagration was to keep the gambling, stateside. Because if people had the choice of, casinos in Cuba or casinos in Las Vegas, the choice, at least for the Eastern Seaboard, is quite obvious.
All right, let me just go over that real quickly for those who are not privy to what you and I were talking about. And also, we had a caller. Yeah, we'll take callers. Is that okay, Jacob? They want to get on this thing?
Absolutely.
You all right with that? Okay, yeah. All right, what Jacob's referring to, and some of you know how I feel about, what I've seen, and that is there is the mainstream thought out there is the mob didn't care about losing Cuba because they had Las Vegas. It was no big deal. I mean, if any of you have any kind of brain, where do you want to be in February? In Las Vegas, or you want to be in Cuba? So there was apparently, this is where I'm going with this, the pressure on JFK to pay back for the election that was definitely thrown his way from the mob in and around Chicago and Clark County. However, you don't touch Cuba, and that goes back to a certain entity in the old world that doesn't want that kind of nation, which is, I'm sorry, Catholic, to be touched. I mean, we won the Spanish-American War, right? Remember that? We take the Philippines, we take Puerto Rico, and we leave Cuba alone. Is that right? And even through the 1960s, through Kennedy's watch especially, we get into a Brinksman situation with a country that has missiles pointed at us. And even to this day, we never consider them in the axis of evil. We're worried about North Korea,
right,
and China and all this other stuff. So my point was that, and I'd like to get the I-Man to come in on this, because this is something we talked about, not on mic, and I mentioned it to him before. It would seem to be, if you can take this as plausible, that Kennedy had a payback and was willing to do that. He knew about Bay of Pigs. He wanted that to happen, and the CIA had bet on him.
Generals gathered in their masses, just like witches at black masses. Evil minds that plot destruction, sorcerers of death's construction. In the fields the bodies burning, as the war machine keeps turning. Death and hatred to mankind, minds. Oh Lord, yeah. Politicians hide themselves away. They only started the war. Why should they go out to fight? They leave that role to the pawn. Time will tell on the making war just for fun, treating people just like pawns in chess. Wait till their judgment day comes. Darkness world stops turning. Ashes where the body's burning. No more war pigs have the power. Hand of God has struck the hour. Day of judgment, world is calling. On the knees, the war pigs crawling. Begging mercy for their sins. Satan laughs. Spreads his wings.
There has been considerable confusion concerning the exact situation in Cuba. The communist propaganda specialists have tried to capitalize on this crisis. President Kennedy already has issued one warning in a note to Nikita Khrushchev, in which he said, "We will honor our obligations if any outside power tries to move into the Cuban fighting." And now to introduce the president, here is Mr. Turner Catledge, president of the ASNE and managing editor of the New York Times.
Mr. Catledge, members of the American Society, newspaper editors, ladies and gentlemen. The president of a great democracy, such as ours, and the editors of great newspapers, such as yours, owe a common obligation to the people, an obligation to present the facts, to present them with candor, and to present them in perspective. It is with that obligation in mind that I have decided in the last 24 hours to discuss briefly at this time the recent events in Cuba. On that unhappy island, as in so many other arenas of the contest for freedom, the news has grown worse instead of better. I have emphasized before that this was a struggle of Cuban patriots against a Cuban dictator. While we could not be expected to hide our sympathies, we made it repeatedly clear that the armed forces of this country would not intervene in any way. Any unilateral American intervention, in the absence of an external attack upon ourselves or an ally, would have been contrary to our traditions and to our international obligations. But let the record show that our restraint is not inexhaustible. Should it ever appear that the inter-American doctrine of non-interference merely conceals or excuses a policy of non-action, if the nations of this hemisphere should fail to meet their commitments against outside communist penetration, then I want it clearly understood that this government will not hesitate in meeting its primary obligations, which are to the security of our nation. Should that time ever come, we do not intend to be lectured on intervention by those whose character was stamped for all time on the bloody streets of Budapest. Nor would we expect or accept the same outcome which this small band of gallant Cuban refugees must have known that they were chancing, determined as they were against heavy odds to pursue their courageous attempts to regain their island's freedom. But Cuba is not an island unto itself, and our concern is not ended by mere expressions of non-intervention or regret. This is not the first time in either ancient or recent history that a small band of freedom fighters has engaged the armor of totalitarianism.
So the silver thing, the Dulles Brothers thing, the Hunt thing, you know, so let me pick up back with the monolithic and ruthless conspiracy speech. I've heard it a million times, and I read it a million times. And just recently, I went back and read it with, and here's a perfect analogy, and you led me to this probably without even knowing it. With all the work you've done with all your guests on Huxley, Brave New World, was he warning us or bragging? In a similar fashion, I think it was, and I re-listened to A Brave New World on audiobook just the other week, and I went in and I listened to it once with the mindset of he's warning us, and then, you know, listen to it. And then I re-listened to it again with the mindset that he was bragging. And you know what? It fits both perfectly, talismanically. It's almost so beautiful if you consider that he wrote that to make both true. In a similar fashion, the monolithic and ruthless conspiracy speech.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. We decided long ago that the dangers of excessive and unwarranted concealment of pertinent facts far outweighed the dangers which are cited to justify it. Even today, there is little value in opposing the threat of a closed society by imitating its arbitrary restrictions. Even today, there is little value in ensuring the survival of our nation if our traditions do not survive with it. And there is very grave danger that an announced need for increased security will be seized upon by those anxious to expand its meaning to the very limits of official censorship and concealment. That I do not intend to permit to the extent that it's in my control. And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know. Today, no war has been declared. And however fierce the struggle may be, it may never be declared in the traditional fashion. Our way of life is under attack. Those who make themselves our enemy are advancing around the globe. The survival of our friends is in danger. And yet no war has been declared. No borders have been crossed by marching troops. No missiles have been fired. If the press is awaiting a declaration of war, before it imposes the self-discipline of combat conditions, then I can only say that no war ever posed a greater threat to our security. If you are awaiting a finding of clear and present danger, then I can only say that the danger has never been more clear, and its presence has never been more imminent. It requires a change in outlook, a change in tactics, a change in missions by the government, by the people, by every businessman or labor leader, and by every newspaper. For we are opposed around the world by a monolithic and ruthless conspiracy that relies primarily on covert means for expanding its sphere of influence, on infiltration instead of invasion, on subversion instead of elections, on intimidation instead of free choice, on guerrillas by night instead of armies by day. It is a system which has conscripted vast human and material resources into the building of a tightly knit, highly efficient machine that combines military, diplomatic, intelligence, economic, scientific, and political operations. Its preparations are concealed, not published. Its mistakes are buried, not headlined. Its dissenters are silenced, not praised. No expenditure is questioned, no rumor is printed, no secret is revealed. It conducts the Cold War in short, with a wartime discipline no democracy would ever hope or wish to match. Nevertheless, every democracy recognizes the necessary restraints of national security. And the question remains whether those restraints need to be more strictly observed if we are to oppose this kind of attack as well as outright invasion.
Though I have no doubts he was referring to one group specifically, the manner and fashion with which that is written, he isn't conclusive to the listener for a direct correlation. So if somebody has a beef with the Jews, that speech fits perfectly. If somebody has a beef with communism, that speech fits perfectly. If you have a beef with the Freemasons, that speech fits perfectly. And it was almost so beautifully crafted to be that vague that it's almost kind of like a weapon to, again, instigate confusion and disorder and divide and conquer.
Very powerful stuff. What more do you want?
John F. Kennedy has finally revealed the truth behind his death in 1963. Speaking at a press conference yesterday, the late American president revealed that he had actually committed suicide.
I had a tiny pistol, which I had gotten specially made, and which I then concealed in my mouth. And at the prescribed time, when the car was level with the book depository, I pulled the trigger with my tongue.
Mr. Kennedy went on to apologize to his wife and family for the years of anguish and called the man accused of his assassination, Lee Harvey Oswald, a true American hero.
Now, go find the others.com.
You know, I don't want to sound like a queer or nothing, but I'm really going to miss you guys when the show's over.